Well, I'm going to talk about DFS, which is a file system that we wrote specifically for the Fusion IO flash disk, but we think some of the lessons probably are interesting for most of the flash devices out there today. I suspect that many people in the audience are already pretty familiar with flash, but I want to kind of review things a little bit for those of you who aren't, and maybe it's a bit of a rehash, but the first question is why flash? And Jim Gray had a good observation, and this has been about 4 years ago now, that tape is dead, disk is tape, flash is disk, RAM locality is king. So, flash is interesting because it's non-volatile and because it has no mechanical components, so you kind of sit to some extent on the Moore's law curve. You don't have to deal with a mechanical disk arm moving back and forth, which for random I.O. is a big deal. It's also inexpensive and getting cheaper, and so it has potential for significant power savings as well. And all that was true in 2006 to some extent, and it's even more so today. So kind of the mantra you'll hear from a lot of people in the flash storage business is, disks, if you're looking to optimize dollars per gigabyte for mass storage, but flash if you're trying to get dollars per I.O. per second. So that's kind of the basic why. So why not battery-backed DRAM? And that's another option, of course. And the fact of the matter is that flash costs less than DRAM, and it's getting cheaper. Both markets are volatile. When a new iPhone comes out, you kind of see a spike in the demand for flash. But the other thing about DRAM is that the memory subsystems that drive them are large and expensive. So we like to think of flash maybe as a new level in the storage hierarchy, that kind of insert it between main memory and disks. I have a little graph here. It's a little bit out of date, but it gives you the general idea of the cost for DRAM versus flash, and you can see that that flash is cheaper and getting cheaper relative to DRAM. And actually, I went and looked late last week at the spot prices for both two common types of flash, and they're more or less sitting on this graph from a couple years ago. So there's a trend there, and that technology trend is driving a lot of the research interest ultimately. The economics are pretty interesting. So let me just kind of review briefly the story from a more technical perspective. Flash is a non-volatile solid-state memory. Individual cells are about the size of a transistor. They're not sensitive to mechanical shock, and that's kind of the original impetus for using it in aerospace applications or on your iPod. However, rewriting a block in flash requires a bulk erase operation. There are a limited number of erase cycles for any given block, and that erase cycle is actually pretty time-consuming relative to the time it takes to read a location or even to program it. Now, there are two common types of flash. We're going to talk exclusively about NAND flash. NOR flash has the advantage of being random access at the word level, and so typically used for firmware. But NAND flash is cheaper because it's denser, and it's there, that's one reason you see it for mass storage devices. There are also two types of memory cells, and one is so-called single-level cell, and that means it encodes a single bit in each location in the flash array, versus MLC, where it's a multi-level cell that encodes multiple bits. And actually, one of the things that's changed in the market or in the space since we've started looking at this project is that you used to hear, well, you have to have SLC to be in the data center, and you're hearing that less and less. MLC is kind of making its way into a lot of these products, and you hear at least the flash vendors talking less about the difference between those two things. Largely, I think, because of the economics, and because at least the flash vendors feel that they have shown that the wear leveling problem is not as big a problem as many people seem to think it is. The endurance is less of an issue. So NAND flash. Let's see here. Individual cells are very simple, and that means that there's an improved fabrication yield. It's often the first thing that's implemented on a new process technology. They already have to deal with failures because if a block wears out, you need to be able to deal with that. So if there are fabrication defects, you can mark them before you ship the part, as long as there aren't too many of them. And there's a very high volume for these flash parts because there are a lot of consumer applications already, and it's starting to be more enterprise applications. For our purposes, one of the important things is that data is organized into pages, and these pages may be as small as 512 bytes, more typically maybe as big as 4 kilobytes. And that's the unit for a read or a write operation. But when you go to write a region that's already been written to before, you have to erase first. And the erase blocks typically encompass many of these pages. They might be as small as 16 kilobytes, say 4 pages, but they might actually be as large as 20 megabytes in some of the high-performance flash disks. And you have to erase the entire erase block before you can reprogram anything in the erase block. And that means that managing erase blocks, and both for wear leveling and for performance, is a real issue. Okay. So what are some of the flash challenges here? Well, we've already touched on the fact that it's block-oriented and not word-oriented, so it's not a direct replacement for main memory. You have to erase an entire erase block at once. And that, in practice, if you want to do bulk erasures, you have to do a copy rather than an update in place. Something that a lot of people are very worried about, understandably, is the wear leveling problem. If you keep erasing and writing to a single location, you're going to burn out that location. It may be a little bit less of an issue if you're copying for performance reasons anyway. You already have to deal with moving data so that you can kind of incorporate the wear leveling algorithms into that process. But to get performance, we've found, at least with the products that we've been using, they have to have significant hardware parallelism and good software support as well. And that includes both for reliability in the form of error correction, but also for performance. So a good question is, well, why another file system? There are a lot of file systems out there. but the thing is, of course, most of these are designed for disks. We have FFS, ZXT, XFS, and so on. One obvious thing is that the layout, there's been a lot of work done over the years for layout specifically to deal with ARM movement delay and so on, which is not an issue with flash. But you could imagine you just run it anyway, and they have good random I/O performance. Maybe it doesn't matter. But one of the things that we observed is that to get good performance, the flash disk is having to do a fair amount of work for dealing with the layout and the copying and garbage collection and so on anyway. And now you've layered another allocator on top of that, and so you have basically two allocators. And not only do you have two allocators, which means there's a little bit less transparency, you also have potentially some interaction between these two allocators. The allocator in the file system gave you this level of indirection for which was useful, but you already have another layer of indirection beneath that. Maybe you don't need both. There has been a fair amount of work on flash file systems, but typically for embedded applications, so things like JFFS and YFFS, are targeted specifically either for NOR or NAND flash. They are log structured. They implement the wear leveling, ECC, and so on, but they're intended for embedded applications. It means the small numbers of files, small files, and small volumes. It's not uncommon for these file systems to have to scan the entire device when they boot up, and that's not particularly efficient on a 160 gigabyte, 320 gigabyte device, or even a terabyte device, which we'll probably be seeing soon. And moreover, often they're expecting to manage the raw flash. So some of them can run on top of a block device, but they've kind of got a lot of assumptions about the flash organization baked into them. So again, the bottom line is that in a server environment, as opposed to an embedded device, we end up with two storage managers, and that seems a little wasteful. So the idea behind DFS is instead of running two storage managers, just delegate. And the file system is still responsible for things like directory management, access control, names, and so on. And the flash disk manager is responsible for dealing with the hard stuff, the block allocation. And moreover, it can co-evolve with the hardware. So it can take advantage of features that are not available in the traditional disk interface, and it can also take advantage of particular quirks of the hardware that the hardware manufacturer knows about. I think there is a longer-term research question here, which is what should the storage interface ideally look like? It's not clear that we need to stick to block read and write interface. We may want to have a richer interface. And I have some thoughts about that, but that's not something that we really explored in depth in this work. Okay, so what are the requirements for DFS? What does it need in order to work? And it currently relies on four features of some of the existing SSDs or SSD replacements. The first is it requires either a sparse block or object-based interface. In the interest of building a prototype, we took advantage of a particular feature of the Fusion I/O hardware that allowed us to have a very, very large sparse address space that mapped down to a smaller physical address space, flash address space. But this could equally apply to an object-oriented interface, and maybe that's the right direction in the long term for the interface to these kinds of devices. We also depend on the flash storage manager being crash recoverable, but you're probably going to be depending on that anyway. So, but that is an important feature. One thing that, particularly for some of for things like dealing with directories, we also depend on the ability to update one or two or more blocks atomically as a unit. Lastly, we depend on an additional interface that allows us to tell the garbage collector that a particular block or range of blocks is no longer in use. And that's not something that something like, say, EXT3 has by default. You can't just say, I no longer care about this block range easily. All four of these, I think, are fairly natural outgrowths of what's necessary to get high performance on flash anyway. So we don't feel that these are strong assumptions. The fact that we have this block remapping or copying for both failed blocks and for performance leads to a natural sparse block or object-based interface. Crash recoverability and atomic multi-block update can be implemented in the context of the log structured storage. It's already there for write performance. And the trim directive actually exists on a lot of flash devices already. So that's not a strong requirement. Okay, here's a little bit busy diagram of the existing approach versus our approach. And the real point here is that in existing SSDs, the SSD sits behind the host bus adapter, and it has the flash translation layer sitting in the SSD, and your interface is this typical storage protocol with read and write to a logical block location. In our approach, we've replaced the traditional block-oriented interface with what we call the virtualized flash storage layer, and that adds these additional features and it could be implemented in the SSD with a slightly different interface than what's typically done over the HBA, or in the case of the particular device we're using, it's actually implemented in a device driver, a proprietary device driver that sits in the operating system kernel. But we don't disturb the user interface, what's outside the kernel. Okay. So this is a simple diagram of the logical address translation. So what happens is that suppose you have opened a file and you reference it through with a particular file descriptor, and you have an offset into that file. How do you figure out where that goes on the flash device? Using this very large, sparse address space, what we do is we say, well, we look up the inode, and the inode tells us a base virtual address that's for that file. And then we take the offset, we put the two together, and we get a large virtual address. And we hand that off to the device, and it is responsible for that mapping from a large virtual address space to the particular physical location that is assigned that virtual address. So this is, you know, that's the that it's that that translation from a virtual from the file's address base to an actual physical location. That's the hard part in a file system. And our observation again is that the storage device has already had to solve this problem or a very similar problem. So why not just piggyback on that? Let them do it. They already have to do it well. Okay, so here's a kind of stepping back or up one level. Here's what an entire DFS file system looks like. We have this very large sparse address space, and we partition it statically into what we call allocation chunks. The flash storage manager maintains the virtual to physical mapping for these allocation chunks. We use the first one as to store the boot block, the super block, and an array of inodes. And then subsequent chunks contain either one large file, which spans an entire allocation chunk, or a number of small files that fit or they're packed into an allocation chunk. And the size of one of these chunks and the small file is chosen when you initialize the file system. So if you know something about your workload, you can maybe make an intelligent choice about those two parameters. But they are fixed when the file system is initialized. So for the directory implementation we have is definitely a work in progress. The current implementation just uses what FFS does, and it does require a little bit of logging on the side to implement that. That additional logging is not done for when you're reading or writing an ordinary file, and we expect to replace this implementation with something that uses the atomic multi-block update feature that's available in the Fusion IO device driver but wasn't exported at the time we started the project. Now the thought is that we can implement the directories as a sparse hash table, again using this fact that we have a very large address space and we can just use a hash table to implement things. Okay, so I'm going to talk briefly here about our evaluation of it. One of the things I want to emphasize is that the Fusion IO product today is 18 months maybe down the pike, and the performance characteristics have changed. I was actually talking to some of the Fusion IO guys earlier today, and clearly it's a much more mature product than it was when we started using it. But the evaluation platform is just a basic white box PC with 4 cores, 4 gigabytes of DRAM running Linux 2.6. And we had a Fusion IO IO drive that has 160 gigabytes of SLC NAND. Now that's the formatted capacity, which means that they actually have maybe 20% more storage that's available to them that allows them to do things like garbage collection more efficiently. So they've already, this is after reserving some overhead for garbage collection and so on. Another thing is that the Fusion IO drive sits on the PCIe bus rather than sitting behind the SATA or SCSI bus. And that means that they have a little bit unusual division of labor, that the device, that more of the secret sauce, if you will, is actually in the device driver as opposed to on the hardware. So there's for the device that we were using, the theoretical peak throughput is about 120,000 IOPS. I think it's now somewhere around 160. The version of the device driver we're using, we definitely saw some bottlenecks that they've been working on since. And that device driver currently exports a block device interface so that you don't have to do anything special to use it. It looks like a disk to consumers inside the kernel and to user level programs. There are some additional features that we can export to things that know that they're not just talking to a disk. And one of those things is that we can, instead of having a 160 gigabyte address space, we can have a full 64-bit virtual address space that the device driver will map down to 160 gigabytes of physical storage for us. One drawback is that this device driver does consume host CPU and memory resources. There are advantages to that. They have more computing power and more memory available to them to do interesting algorithms than they might on the hardware device itself, but the device is also competing with applications for resources. Okay, so start with a few micro benchmark results. First one is look at random reads. We know that Flash tends to be better at reads than writes. In this case, we're just looking at 4 kilobyte IOs per second and look at it as a function of the number of threads. And the key point here is that unlike with a disk, aggregate performance actually improves with more threads, up to a point, of course. On the particular combination of hardware and device driver that we had, the raw performance is about peaks out at about 100,000 IOs per second. Of course, you're measuring here both the Fusion IO device, the particular device version of the device driver, and the host CPU and memory performance fits into this as well. What we see here is that DFS doesn't have that both DFS and EXT3, which is a straw man that we're going to compare against, perform pretty close to the native hardware, the raw hardware performance. And that's not too surprising. I was talking to recently to some of the Fusion IO folks, and one of the artifacts here that I think is kind of obvious is that between 8 and 16 threads, it kind of flattens out before it continues up again. That's a little bit odd. That has actually to do with some of the scheduling of IOs in the device driver and hardware. And I think that's something that they've addressed since. But you'll notice that it's not as we see it for both file systems and for the raw device access. Okay, so for random writes, again, there's essentially the same graph. We're looking at 4K IOs, random IOs, as a function of the number of threads. Again, we need multiple threads to get the best aggregate performance, although we reach peak performance at a lower level of concurrency. And that has to do with some of the hardware architecture of the device as well, the amount of hardware parallelism that's available. There's also an additional garbage collector thread running on the host, and it's perhaps a little bit less evident in this graph because we're doing purely I/O, and we're not CPU bound yet. But as we'll see in the next graph, if you look at not just the I/O performance, but how many cycles do you have to expend to get that level of performance, that the impact of the garbage collector running on the host is evident. Okay, here's a little table showing that. So what we have here is this is the percentage improvement in CPU usage if you go from EXT3 to DFS. So just so we're clear, that means that a positive 14% means that you're basically using 14% less CPU on DFS, and a minus 17% means you're using 17% more CPU. It's an improvement. It's kind of perhaps a little bit backward, but that's the way we have it in the paper, and I want it to be in parallel with that. So I think the real takeaway here is that for reads, there is a small performance improvement at low levels of concurrency, but more or less, there isn't a whole lot of difference. For writes, there's a more substantial improvement, particularly for random writes, if you have fewer than 4 threads. Recall that our test platform has 4 cores, and with 4 threads and 4 cores, 4 client threads, 4 cores, and a garbage collector thread, you end up thrashing a bit. Not surprising, but you know, there it is in the numbers, just as you'd expect. Okay. We also put together a small benchmark of some applications to get a better sense of what's going on. The first is just a quick sort. So in this case, we just memory map a file and do a single-threaded quick sort of that memory map file. This particular benchmark actually came about in order to build the database for the next one, an n-gram database. And I said, well, you know, your first inclination is to use some external sorting package and get clever about it. And then you realize, well, with Flash, I can just memory map it and, you know, be done with it. But actually, we saw some real performance difference there, too. And particularly for people doing, say, scientific applications where they don't have a lot of deep knowledge about optimization, they just need to get a task done. The fact that you can profitably use memory mapped I/O is actually interesting. The ngram benchmark is just it's the Google ngram corpus doing random queries to that. The KNN imputer is a missing value estimation program for bioinformatics data. VM update is simultaneously updating a whole bunch of VMs hosted on Flash, which is turns out to be a pretty popular application for Flash and a point of pain for a lot of people. And then TPCH, which is just a decision support benchmark. So quickly, here what we have is we get some speedups, and they range from 7%, only 7% for the VM update, where we're primarily CPU bound pretty quickly, to things like the ngram corpus, where I actually get a big speed up. And it turns out that part of that big speed up is that because DFS is simpler, it has less locking overhead, especially when all the threads are banging on the same file. And you see this very dramatically if you look at the number of voluntary context switches in that application benchmark. A lot of the others, they see the performance improvement because in Linux there's a get block function that's supplied by the file system to do the mapping to pick up blocks from a particular file given an offset in the file. And it's simpler here, and since it's virtually contiguous, you can very easily issue a big I/O for a range of bytes without doing a lot of prefetching or clever work. Let's see here. So what's kind of the takeaway message here? I think, you know, with a little secret sauce, NAND flash actually is interesting. People have been talking a lot about, say, some of the SSDs, like the Intel SSD, which is getting, say, 3,500, 4,000 IOs per second. We actually have real devices out there that can do 100,000, and that is a big step forward, pretty interesting. There's no need for flash to sit behind a traditional mass storage bus. So if we kind of willing to break the mold a little bit, maybe we can get even more performance or some interesting features. So delegating the storage management allows us to simplify the system software. We can get some performance improvement. And although we don't have to change the storage protocols, maybe it would be interesting to do so. Also allows the storage vendor to innovate in the storage management while keeping the operating system and system software separate and stable. Okay. So David Flynn, who's sitting here in the front, is the CTO at Fusion.io, and he's supported the research both in terms of providing hardware and some insight into what's going on. And I've also had quite a few conversations with Garrett Swart over at Oracle about all of this.
Wen Guowang from Ample. How much memory does the device driver use? And when running DFS, do you use more driver memory or less driver memory compared to EXT3?
It's a good question. I think that's one of the things that's probably changed. Maybe David can just give a very quick description of that, because that mapping in the version that we have been using is all in DRAM, but I think they've been working on paging that out.
Dependent on the write extent size. It's using an extent-based mapping. So if you're writing very small chunks, the tables take more space. One way to think of this is it's like your virtual memory page tables that are translated by the CPU. We translate the logical block to physical NAND location the same way a page table translates the virtual memory to physical memory location. So we've in essence integrated flash in a memory controller, memory address translation-esque approach as opposed to storage. So it does vary depending on the write size.
Good morning. Drew Wilson, currently with SanDisk, but formerly with Sun. And I was thinking when you were describing your file system, it sounded an awful lot like ZFS. Did you, particularly with large pointers and sparse space and hash tables to look things up, did you consider looking at ZFS at all or using it in this research?
That's a good question. I didn't have a Sun box I could plug one of the. I mean, part of the thing was the Fusion I/O device in particular. It requires driver support, and I don't think I think you support Sun now, but didn't at the time, as I recall. So that wasn't really an option for ZFS, because my experience with ZFS on 386 is when we started this, it wasn't in a stable enough position. I could be wrong about that, but.
Okay, well, that's a fair answer. Thanks.
Hi there, Keith Smith, NetApp Advanced Technology Group. I like the idea of sort of, you know, I like the observation that you don't need to do the remapping in two different places and just collapsing it down to one. I'm wondering, you know, by collapsing it into a single flat address space, though, it seems like you're losing some information, particularly about what blocks belong to the same files and things like that. And if you had an interface to do something that looked more like an object disk, would do you think that would make this work better?
That's a good question. I haven't thought hard to determine whether it would make it work better, but that would be, I think, a more natural implementation. You know, the fact of the matter is that we'd talked seriously about doing that before we realized that we could maybe do the 90% solution and get a sense of whether it was even worth pursuing. And I think the answer is it's worth pursuing, and that an object-based interface is probably the long-term the right way to go.
I am Fabiano from EMC, and I was wondering why you didn't use, there is other file system designed for flash devices. Some free ones you can find in the literature. Why you didn't use other flash file system to compare against your approach?
It's a good question. We talked about that a little bit briefly earlier. That I mean, the constraint is that we needed one that was open source and ran under Linux because of the device driver constraint at the time. They support more platforms now, and the ones that we were looking at wouldn't. Most of them assumed that they had raw access to the flash, as you do on an embedded device, and that is not the case. There's actually quite a bit architecturally going on the Fusion IO device, so you can't actually access raw NAND. One thing that's become available since we started this is the ability to run that file system on a kind of a block file system emulator, and that postdates the work. It might be interesting, but again, you've introduced a layer of indirection, and part of the point was to eliminate that indirection.
Sam No, Hongik University from Seoul, Korea. Your file system seems to be targeted towards Fusion I/O, and we've had experience developing file systems, and we found that the file system performance is very sensitive to the platform, depending on what kind of, you know, how much memory you have, what kind of FTLs they're using, and such. Could you say a few things about that?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I guess one of our observations was that. Within a single manufacturer, as the hardware evolves, the point here is that the work on the device driver, you just get that for free in your file system. You don't have to retune the file system for the particular device. That the flash management and the flash device itself can evolve in conjunction. It's also the case that our approach requires a slightly different interface to flash than the typical block-oriented. So it doesn't. It's not obviously backward compatible with something like some of the well-known SSDs out there. We're taking advantage of either of an object-based interface or this sparse interface. I don't see any technical reason why that richer interface couldn't be exported from other SSDs, however.